Welcome back to Dark Florida. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland, Bigfoot field researcher, adventurer, and your guide through the eerie and the unexplained. Here on Dark Florida, we dive into true crime, historical oddities, cryptid encounters, paranormal experiences, and strange news, with a special focus on boots-on-the-ground investigations in real, first-hand accounts. If you enjoy the show, you can follow me on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/darkflorida11. And you can support the show at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. If you have a story to share or you would like to be a guest on the show, you can always email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. Wherever you're listening, be sure to drop a 5-star review. It really helps the show. Our guest on today's show is Marcia Clark, retired Marine, National Guard veteran, former Exxon geologist, as well as longtime investigator with the BFRO, the Bigfoot Field Research Organization. Marcia has spent much of her life in the field exploring some of the most remote places on Earth, from the wilds of Alaska to the jungles of Madagascar, and has hiked and camped in all 63 U.S. national parks. With a strong background in science and a commitment to the scientific method, Marcia actively researches infrasound, EMR, and EMF phenomena as they relate to Bigfoot. Over the past 30 years, she has participated in expeditions across the country, including Montana, Idaho, California, Alaska, Arizona, and many more BFRO expeditions in the Southeast and Midwest. Along the way, she has experienced Class A Bigfoot encounters, physical contact, witnessed orbs and shadow figures, and even encountered the phenomena known as mind speak. Marcia brings a wealth of experience, scientific rigor, and a true passion for the unknown, and I am so excited to have her on with us. Thank you for joining us, Marcia.
Hey, you're welcome, Brooke. I really thank you for asking me.
Absolutely. We met on my very first BFRO expedition, and I was just blown away by just your knowledge. You are a wealth of knowledge, and you have so many cool tips and tricks and great information. I'm sure that the listeners are going to love that. If you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you into Bigfoot and the BFRO.
Yeah, I'm well-traveled, retired from the United States Marine Corps. I'm a graduate from UCLA and UCR. I have dual master's degrees in geophysics and geology. I spent a time with the Army Corps of Engineers, retired from it. I did a 2-year stint with the United States Geologic Survey as a grad student doing contract work. And finally ended up with Mobil, that became ExxonMobil, as a field geologist, and ended up retiring from there as well. My first introduction to Bigfoot was way back when I was in the Marine Corps. 1984, in the winter, going to Marine Corps cold weather winter training facility in Bridgeport, California, standing for what Marine Corps calls their version of guard duty is called fire watch. Standing fire watch and being outside in the cold, the snow, and at about 32 to 35 feet away, a large adult male stood out from behind a large tree. We locked eyes for about a good 5 or 6 seconds. I mean, literally 5 or 6 Mississippis. And I had my beam in my hand, and we just locked eyes and just froze. He stepped away back behind the tree, took off, was gone. I later reported that to my staff sergeant, and he told me to log it in the logbook as I encountered indigenous wildlife, and to leave it at that. I concluded my career in the Marine Corps some way past that. I would always have this encounter in the back of my mind wherever I went, knowing that there was something out there. And I would try to leave it alone, and it would still be there. Later, retiring from the Marine Corps, I'm doing field work for USGS. I'm doing field work for geotechnical engineering companies, and all of a sudden I find myself in the deep woods of Montana, Idaho, Northern California, and I would be by myself doing field mapping or whatever. I would have these strange things occur and I didn't know what they were. I'd find these huge areas of weeds that were matted down 30, 40 feet from my tent, 9, 10 foot diameter, and didn't know what that was. Sometimes it sort of seemed like I had something being thrown at me, but I didn't know what it meant. I was kind of oblivious to it. I didn't follow Bigfoot or any type of cryptid per se. I got out of doing that work and sort of settled in Southern California. And all of a sudden, I ran across these blue discussion boards for an organization called BFRO. This, gosh, almost 20 years ago. And I started reading. It was, wow, people here with a lot of insight, a lot of information and knowledge. And so I just began following that. It wasn't until some time later, I returned back to the United States. I'm retired from ExxonMobil. And I started to follow up on some of these thoughts I had had and what I had read in the blue discussion boards and whatnot with BFRO. I started just venturing out and reading serious work of Dr. Meldrum and others. Being a scientist myself, I have 32 professional papers out there written on science, specifically for geotechnical engineering, quake fault reports, etc. So I know how to write a professional scientific paper. And that's sort of how I look at this adventure that I'm on now. I try to stick and adhere to the scientific method at all times. Sometimes that's kind of hard because I've seen and experienced things that I literally cannot explain. I can't. I make note of them. I document them. But I can't explain it. And others, I think I have a pretty good handle on. And so I got to my first expedition with BFRO in Ohio, and I was hooked. That particular expedition, I was actually touched or pushed through the sidewall of my tent. I had an encounter with another group of the attendees, actually witnessing a hunting party of a female squatch, 2 juveniles, and 2 males, and hearing screams and them running through camp, and it was just incredible. And that got me hooked. And so. With the BFRO, I have been, I believe it's now 25 expeditions with BFRO, between Ohio, Tennessee, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, West Virginia, Pennsylvania. I pretty much stay right along both sides of the Appalachian, and I've been out as many times as that or more by myself, on my own, or leading other private groups, smaller groups, 4, 5, 6 at a time. And all in the attempt of really gathering the hard, reproducible evidence. I'm not going to throw away the woo faction, and I'm not going to, throw away the science faction. I throw all that away, and I just simply collect the data and see what pops out. And that's where I've been on this journey. There have been some paranormal occurrences throughout this journey as well. I guess we can discuss that after the fact. But with Sasquatch, I see this, at least this is what's displayed to me right here, right now, is a breathing, pooping, bleeding hominid that lives in the forest. It reproduces, obviously, like we humans do. So it leaves physical evidence, it leaves hair, it leaves fecal matter, it leaves footprints. We hear all those things. Now, I can't say they jump in and out of portals or they're part of UFOs or any of that other. I have no proof of that, nor do I have any observations of that. However, after my first encounter, which was Class A, straight up my eyes to its in California in 1984, I've had 2 other subsequent Class A in my face sightings, unaided by FLIR or binoculars or anything else. And one of those was in Tennessee, the Chihaui Recreation Area. That was a pretty scary encounter. We had done a BFRO expedition there, and it was a great expedition. If anyone in the audience wants to pick one expedition to go on or 2, please search out Miss Lori Wade with her expeditions in Tennessee, and you will not be disappointed. I guarantee you. Anyhow, being one of her team leads out there working for her, she had rented this huge tent because we had, you know, rainy weather, etc. And so that 50, 60 people could be underneath it to have meetings and meals, etc. However, the rental company couldn't get there until Monday morning. And so I and another person volunteered to stay behind there and wait for the rental company to come pick up this huge rented, looks like a miniature circus tent. And so at the end of the conclusion of the expedition on Sunday morning, we sort of watched everyone leave and whatnot. And so when normal after an expedition, you walk around, you pick up trash and see if people forgot things and make a note of where they were. So maybe you have to mail it back to them or whatnot. And so about 2:30, 3 o'clock, I have my Bigfoot wagon that fits on the roof of my car, and I'm pulling it along and I'm looking for firewood. We had Miss Wade buy some of the best firewood you can. I don't know how she finds it, but she does. This beautiful dry seasoned red oak firewood. So I go over, it's about 60, 70 yards away from my campsite, and there's a stack of this wood stacked up by a fire ring. And I'm going to walk over there and get it. The people left it behind and use it to burn in my campfire. And I go over there and I'm sitting at their picnic table, slowly putting the firewood into my wagon. And at my 2 o'clock, 2:30-ish in my field of vision, there's a 6 foot, maybe 180, 200 pound, very thinly haired, conical head, very slender, what I believe is a juvenile Sasquatch. It pokes its head up from behind a tree, and it runs to another tree, now at my 3:30, and all I'm trying to control my breathing, I'm trying to remain calm, not jump up and yell and point. And so as I'm picking up the firewood and setting the wagon, I'm slowly turning my body to capture a little more view, hopefully. And sure enough, I'm just getting that tree he ran to in my view, and he runs to a third tree. And now he's so far behind me, I make it too obvious for me to turn around and see him and whatnot. But I do it. I want to see him again. I'm trying to figure out where I left my phone to take a picture. I'm trying to wonder, gosh, I normally wear a body cam, and I left it back in my tent. And this is daytime. I'm not anticipating any encounters. Mm-hmm. And I finally turned around to that third tree, and that juvenile's gone. My next thought is that juveniles typically don't venture on their own without their parent, mom or dad or both. So I have to assume at that point that there are others around me. Now, to set the picture for you, in this area, the state was closing this entire area down. The park ranger said there was going to be no one there. They're off on meetings. And even the host that was three camping areas away had left for a day and a half. So I was literally, myself and my field partner, were the only ones there, the only humans. Probably, I don't know, the whole rec area, 20,000 acres, maybe bigger. And so I get on the radio, I call my field partner, I go, hey, guess what? Guess what happened? Please come down this trail so you can see footprints, etc. And he walks down this back trail where perhaps the juvenile could have gone to, and he didn't see any tracks. Okay. So he goes back to his tent, and he radios me about 10 or 15 minutes later. Says, Marsha, I really, really, really am sorry, but I got to go. Okay. So he packs up and leaves. So at that point, I realized I'm the only person there. I'm the only human. And I'm pretty much anticipating encounters throughout the night at this point. It's getting dark, weather fronts moving in, rain, fog, etc. And I finally go back, rest that firewood. I put it by my fire ring. I set up like a little detection, a grid around my tent. Behind me are huge rhododendron plants. So I back my car up on one side of my tent, which is an 8x16, 7 foot tall. So to block off one, no access at all to one side of my tent. On the other, I tip a picnic table up on end so the bench is in the ground. And I use that on the other side. I stack my totes and the ammo cans that I use for supplies. I put those around the WISA area. And I have it up there so if something comes near me, I can hear it. I can detect it. It's getting a little bit darker now. Sun's about setting. And I start a pot of coffee. I go, something else I'm going to do. I have these little personal alarms, electrical alarms. They have a built-in battery. And if you pull the pin, they screech, 65, 70 decibels. And so I normally take those when I'm by myself. And I deploy a 4-pound fishing line all the way around my camp and hook it to this alarm. Now, if something touches the table, touches my car, something, I'll be able to understand it's there. Or if it comes even closer, that pin will get pulled and boom, there'll be a screeching alarm. So I get that all established and coffee's done. I fill up my thermos. I go inside my tent. In there, I have, full cot, table, like a workspace, workstation, laptop, etc. And I sit in my chair. I have a cup of coffee, I'm reading my book, I'm making notes of everything I had just seen that afternoon when everyone gone. And it's getting a little bit later, it's about 10:30, 11 o'clock, and all of a sudden, that little personal alarm goes off, starts shrieking. And uh-oh. So I listen real close, I look out. I was at the top of the door of the tent, and I'm looking around, and I don't see anything there. I walk out there. I go to where the alarm is. My thought is, okay, maybe a squirrel jumped out of a tree and hit the fishing line. Maybe a stick fell. That was my first thought. And so I hold the alarm and the pin up in the light of my headlamp so I can see it, and I put the pin back in it to turn it off. That's the only way to turn it off is put that pin in it. And so I put a little bit more slack in the line, and I go back in my tent. Well, now when I go back in my tent, just to be on the safe side, because the expedition's over, I pulled the rifle out of my car, and I made sure it's loaded, and I keep it in the tent with me. Woman by herself, big area. I think it's only prudent. So about, half hour later, all of a sudden I hear on this little gravel trail next to me, I hear very slow footsteps. They're not bipedal, though. It sounds like a bear. They're very sloppy, very slow steps. So I use the key bob to my car. I hit the panic on it, and the lights and the horn go off, and now all of a sudden you can hear, yeah, it's a bear. And it runs away. You can hear it stomping away. So, okay, that worked well. I get that turned off, and I refresh my coffee, and I'm still sitting there making notes and reading some other publications and whatnot. And now I get this little bit of, drizzle-type rain, and all of a sudden, that alarm goes off again. I go, again, my first thought is I've left too much tension in the line. And so I go to put my boots on. This time I pick up my rifle, I go to unzip the tent, and the alarm turned off. Well, I know that alarm cannot be turned off with a switch, you remove the battery, nothing. The only way you can turn it off is by putting the pin back in it. And you have to have, opposing thumbs to do that. Well, I yelled out, "Don't F with me, I'm armed." I'm thinking maybe it's a transient person or whatever, And I cocked in my rifle, chambered around. And I'm thinking, things are going to get tedious. And I take a deep breath. I unzip the door. I zip it down. I'm looking out, and the entire alarm is gone. Just the two ends of the fishing line dangling in the breeze. I go, oh, boy, this is just getting stranger and stranger. Things seem to be just ratcheting upward. So I pull out the second one, normally carry three or four, and this time I bungee it to a tree and give it more slack and line and go back in my tent. I sit in my chair, rifle across my lap, and to be quite honest with you, I'm sort of bouncing back and forth in my chair, anticipating trouble. I'm thinking, I'm having an encounter with a Sasquatch, I'm going to have an encounter with a human, both. I don't know what I'm going to encounter. However, this is really getting dangerous. I remember sitting in my chair, rifle across my lap. It's the last thing I remember. After which, it's now 7:15, the sun is rising, and I'm laying on my cot with my rifle in my hand on the side of me. After drinking almost a full pot of coffee and being totally amped up, waiting for some kind of encounter, I passed out. I'll put an asterisk next to that statement because we can revisit that. So that's important. So I'm trying to get my wits about me, figuring out what happened, what's going on. And I can hear something moving right outside the door of my tent, like 3, 4, 5 feet. And so I shoot up, wipe out my eyes, I check my rifle. And again, I yell, "Don't F with me. I'm armed. You better get out of here." And I unzip the top of the tent door, and there's a coyote. That picnic table was back down on all fours. My totes and my supply ammo cans are now unstacked and laying loosely all over the ground. And there's a coyote standing atop of the picnic table just staring at me. And I shoo him away, and he takes off. And I'm still kind of confused on what's been going on, especially I'm used to staying awake all night. I mean, what's the big deal? What happened? And so I come out of my tent. I start water for oatmeal and coffee. I pick up my gear a little bit, sort of organize it. And I'm sitting in my chair, and I take out my notebook, my write in the rain notebook. And I pull out a pen where the tip lights up. So you don't need a headlamp to see when you're writing. And as I'm waiting for coffee, water to heat up, I'm writing down everything I can remember while it's still fresh. I'm writing it down, and I hear this loud crack, almost as loud like a 410 shotgun, but it's over by that rental tent, which is about 150, 200 yards away from me. And I was so worried. I'm here to watch this tent. And my first thought was the wind blew a branch into it and ripped it. You know, I was so worried. So I know Lori had signed for that tent. And so I turned the water off. I put my notebook and my pen down. I grab my rifle and I start walking over there. Well, this time it's foggy. And it's so foggy, you can't see more than 30, 40 feet in front of you. Literally cannot see that far. And I keep going over and walking closer and closer to the tent. I don't see anything. All of a sudden, I see this little mound where the trees were growing out of. There's a limb broke off the side of this tree. The limb's about 5, 5.5 inches in diameter. And it was broke cleanly off the side of the tree, about 8.5, 9 foot up in the air. And it was just laying there on the ground. It had not hit the tent. Nothing. At this point, the hair raised up on my neck, on my arms. The first word I thought in my head was ambush. Going back to my Marine Corps days, first thing I thought of was ambush. And I did a 360 sweep with my rifle. I'm in a crouched position. I'm thinking something's going to come at me. Nothing did. I go, okay, I'm done playing. I'm out of here. I have the key to the gate. I'm going to pack and unlock the gate, leave the key in the lock, and tell the rental company, lock it up when you're done. So I go back to my camp and turn the water back on. I grab my notebook, so I'm going to write this down, and my pen's gone. Okay, what happened to my pen? This is stupid, you know. So anyhow, I've had another one, and I finished my notes, I finished my coffee, my oatmeal, and sun's now up, the fog is dissipated. It's just a little breezy, a little cloudy, and I start getting my camp put away. And I get it all put away in my car, except for my wagon, my rifle, and my chair. And I'm thinking, well, I'm going to another expedition in 3 days from here. So I'm going to go over and grab that what's left over of all this firewood and pack it in my car so I have something to contribute at the next expedition, you know. And so I walk over to the other fire ring, start collecting all the firewood, and on that picnic table is my lighted tip pen. That told me right away I had been manipulated. I had been misled the entire time. When I walked over there to check out that tent and that branch being broken, a Sloth ran through and stole that pen. And on my way back, I must have scared him because he put it on the picnic table. Sloth is like, you know, red lights, orange lights, and the tip of this pen lights up red. Right? So I go, the heck with the wood, heck with all that. And so I go back to my camp. I throw the wagon up on the roof, my car. I bungee it in. I walk around to the driver's side of my car. And there on my driver's window is a white, oily handprint. Apparently, Squash was right there watching me, right there. And so open the door. I stuck my rifle in the passenger seat with me. And, you know, the chair was up underneath the wagon. I shut the door, and I threw gravel, doing a U-ey out of there. Got to the gate, unlocked it, left the gate open, left the key in the lock, and went to a lookout spot where I could report to Miss Wade as to what I had done, and that I was going to wait there for the rental company to come by. I'm not going to wait there at that camp. So it's about an hour later, the rental company beat their horn, drove by. Okay, you're good. I'm out of here. That was a very, very scary experience, I'm telling you. That was something else. Where I said we need to put an asterisk here, I belong to a PTSD support group at the Veterans Hospital. And yes, I'm diagnosed with PTSD. What my medical people told me was that I probably had a unique reaction when I was sitting in the chair, that I must have encountered something that my brain didn't want me to deal with. And it's called disassociation. It happens to folks, happens to children, adults, anyone. When you experience something that is just beyond your capability of accepting or recognizing or whatever, and your brain just shuts it off. It won't let you remember. Now, the VA has offered for therapy, hypnosis, and whatnot to find out what that was. I have declined. I feel I survived the first whatever it was. I don't want to go through it again. In retrospect, that was the second time in my life where I've had a disassociative event occur. So at this time now, when I go out on expeditions in my camp, one, I make sure my cot is at least 12 inches away from any wall of my tent. And two, I put a carabiner through all the toggles of the zippers of my tent door so that you can't be on the outside and unzip it. If you're going to come in the tent, you're going to have to cut it open. You're going to have to wake me up to cut it open. I also, probably 3/4 of the time, put 4-pound fishing string all the way around the tent, put a little personal alarm on it, so that you have to cut the tent and you have to activate an alarm. I can't sleep when I'm in the field unless I do all these things now. It's because of that trauma. Maybe it was not my best decision to make when my field partner had to go. I think he had a personal reason why he had to go. Maybe it wasn't my best decision making of staying there. Maybe I could have came back in the morning, I could have left, got a hotel room, came back in the morning, and met the rental company there. Maybe that would have been the better decision to do. I'm still debating that.
Right. It was curious because you were alone.
Yeah. Now, subsequently, I don't know, 6 months later, I'm on another expedition and I'm talking to that expedition leader, and she says, "Oh, by the way, just to follow up, Marcia, to your encounter, the Rangers and the Sheriff's Department did get calls that weekend of a very large, dark figure trying to open RVs and door handles and whatnot, looking in the windows the whole weekend." So that sort of added a little reinforcement to the situation. Then, like I said, you get on many expeditions, and sometimes, they're not always gravy and something noteworthy to call National Geographic about. Sometimes it rains all weekend, and the only encounters and any other information you gather may be having acorn thrown at you, and that's it. Maybe a tree knock. On that Florida expedition that you attended, that final night, Saturday night, I led a group of people, five people out, and we went to this area north of our base camp. And we had gone out there during the day, scoped it out, went back there that night. And my usual MO is I'll set up a little circle of people, and once we get established as to where we're at, then I'll send out teams of two or three people at a time out on the trails to go out for no more than 10, 15 minutes and come back. They're armed with a radio, et cetera, and we stay in contact, and hopefully to sort of agitate a reaction or an encounter. Maybe they'll go out, and all which happens quite frequently, they'll take off to the east and we'll get a tree knock from the distant east. And then maybe a subsequent tree knock to the west. So this particular time during that expedition, I send two teams out, one east, one west. And as we're sitting, I'm sitting there with the last remaining person, because you're not by yourself. He's sitting across from me, looking behind me, and I'm looking behind him. And all of a sudden, the forest just lit up like it was daylight. Literally, it looked like daylight to us. None of my EMF, EMR equipment worked. My FLIR just had a blank screen, would not work. Each team, when they looked back at us, said it looked like there was a dome of white light around us, maybe as tall as maybe as tall as a telephone pole, which is normally 35 to 40 feet. It was bright light, just like it was daytime, but beyond that, it got super dark. And the effect lasted about a good 10 minutes. When the group started coming back, I couldn't radio them. They just came back on their own. All of a sudden, the light went away. It just went away, and everything was normal after that. Don't know what happened. It's like something shined a spotlight down on me and this other person that was super intensely bright white, and it blocked or jammed every electrical item we had. That was kind of really unusual. I didn't know how do you write a report that says that's related to Bigfoot? I don't know. I don't know. But now, I gotta be honest with you, my first thought was David Politis 411. I was like, oh no. But nothing came of it. I mean, it was just this intense light that looked like daylight, and a radius of about 45, 50 feet, and about that high, maybe a little lower. And both groups of people, one to the east, one to the west, looking back towards us, saw it quite plainly and started walking back. And so that was very, very unusual. I can't even say it's paranormal. I don't know what to call that. It's one of those things, like I referenced earlier, I've experienced things that all I can do is record them and take the notes and the information and see how it fits into the puzzle later down the road. One of the things I do is I record data for electromagnetic fields and for electromagnetic radiation. I record analyzers for infrasound. I also carry a signal generator with me that I hold on a broadcast infrasound. On one occasion, I watched someone being zapped, literally fell to their knees out of their chair. When he fell forward, I looked with my FLIR to my right, and I could see a Squatch with my FLIR 60 feet, 70 feet away in the tree line. At the same
Wow.
time, all my meters that are in front of me are all redlining and pegging. I'm seeing intense levels in terms of micro Tesla and micro Seville. Just totally, just if you saw these readings and you're walking through a hospital or a factory or something, you were an OSHA person, you would say, hey, shut this down. This is unsafe. Empty the building. And it lasted for a good 30 seconds. At the same time, this person fell forward, claiming to be zapped. That point on now, I record all that data every time I go out. I've experienced that a second time where I have actually seen someone under the influence of infrasound. I measured it with 7.5 hertz. It lasted for approximately 39 seconds, and the EMF was this, the EMR was this, and it went away as fast as it came. So now I'm starting to develop hardcore, scientific, reproducible data, and that I can go and say, this is what's happening. Now, how do you follow up with that? I have taken the liberty to go and interview two great ladies who were large mammal specialists at two zoos that are internationally acclaimed. And I've interviewed them about large animals, mammals, and how they use infrasound. It's not quite like how we think, but they use it. And it depends on the size and the length of the vocal cords, how much air, the atmospheric pressure. There's a lot of factors involved. And some of it involves the sensitivity of the intended recipient of that infrasound. When a tiger uses it, for example, they don't sit on a mountaintop and broadcast at a certain frequency and everything within 10 miles falls down. That's not how it works. They may be 25, 30 feet away, and they will wait till they have their target isolated. And it'll be very deliberate. It'll be very short bursts, and boom, it'll stun that prey. That's generally how they use it. And so if I apply that model to Squatch and say they're applying it with a definite intention and it's directed towards one thing or one person, and then they're large enough to produce, they have the air capacity, the voice box, the vocal cords of a certain length, everything comes together, and the person who actually experiences that sound, their eardrums and their physiology is susceptible to that particular frequency. Because I'd ask the question that I watched this man fall to the ground, why didn't it affect me? Why didn't it, the person who's sitting on the other side of him? And it didn't, but it affected him. And it must be because he is susceptible to that particular wavelength, that particular frequency. And I am not, simply put. In a later expedition, I recorded two Squatches, I believe, one at one particular frequency, one at another, conversing back and forth from different sides of our camp. One at approximately 8 hertz and the other one at 12 hertz. There'd be a call and effect. All normally unheard of the human ear, but when you have an analyzer sitting in front of you recording the trace, you can see it. There's a 5-second burst at 8. There's a response 2 seconds at 12 and a half and back and forth. So apparently, one hypothesis, they're not only using infrasound, perhaps for hunting, perhaps they're using it as a form of communication. That could be a very potential idea. No one was injured when we experienced that, but I was able to watch it transpire right in front of me while it was occurring.
I think you were telling me we had gone out one night and you had all your equipment. And I was like, what is all that? And you were telling me these are things that the USGS uses too, I believe you said, right?
Yeah, I have a couple friends. Yeah, I have a few friends that are, you know, obviously still in academia, and I stay in contact with them. And well, what they're listening for is different responses. There are certain wavelengths of sound that are emitted with fault movement, with two sections of an earth moving, and they'll emit a certain wavelength just prior to a frictional occurrence in a landslide. There'll be a short burst of sound in a certain particular wavelength related to the bedrock type. And the same thing will happen with earthquake faults and whatnot. So I've just adapted it for a slightly different use, but it's still the same thing. Sound is being emitted and I want to record it. I want to observe it. And that's what I'm doing. And with the EMF and EMR, on occasions I have seen orbs. I've seen white and I've seen blue. I cannot explain. I know I'm a licensed meteorologist, geologist, and engineer. They are not ball lightning. I guarantee it. On deposition, they are not ball lightning. It is something completely different. I just can't explain it. With the white orbs, sometimes they're about the size of a cue ball, sometimes maybe size of a grapefruit. They seem to travel at a certain elevation above the ground. And we go in and out of trees. I can't explain that. With blue, I've seen it avoid trees. I've seen it avoid cars. And I've seen it hover and come to a stop and then dive into the ground. I can't explain that. I can't. The best I can do is make mention of it. I have the EMF readings from when they occurred. I know what levels of electromagnetic radiation were experienced. But other than that, I can't explain those, not in a scientific manner. So I'm not going to disagree with someone that says, well, maybe the squatches turn into orbs or the orbs turn into squatches. I can't say yes or no. I'm just saying that I know the frequencies of which, when I've observed them, what was the electromagnetic effect. I also know that where I've seen these orbs, there are previously mapped by the United States Geological Survey very strong positive magnetic anomalies in the bedrock. Does that have something to do with it? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
Because I was going to ask you if there was any geological features or land formations that you found that seemed to correlate with sightings.
Well, with sightings for Bigfoot, there is a strong correlation. With orbs, not so much. But with Bigfoot, yes. If you look at a map, a geologic map of the United States, and if we color or shade all the areas that have a heavy amount of what's called karst topography, there in Florida, everyone's familiar with karst topography because that's where your groundwater is located, in those underground aquifers that are enclosed by limestone. Okay, that is karst topography. That the surface of the land is influenced and crafted by the limestone that's underneath your feet. Meaning there are caverns, both filled with water and not so filled with water. When you have a sinkhole, what has happened? That's the limestone in the bedrock has dissolved and the overburden has sunk with the loss of that support. Okay? Well, that limestone, that karst topography, exists throughout Florida, parts of Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and exists heavily into Texas and parts of Oklahoma. Are you seeing a trend here? Now, let's shade another area. Current or past areas of volcanism, where there's previous volcanic tubes, volcanic shells, etc. There are areas in Arkansas and Missouri where there is old paleo volcanic geology. Quite similar throughout California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, parts of northern Nevada, Wyoming, etc. In fact, in the Northwest, Native Americans used to use these caves. They'd call them ice caves. They would store meat all summer in these old volcanic tubes that they would call ice caves. In fact, there's a couple state parks that are called Ice Cave State Park, where you go down in them and the temperature is freezing. And they're vast cavernous areas. And so anyhow, when you map those types of geology on the United States, and you overlay that with a map of sightings of Bigfoot, you'll see there's a very strong correlation. Now, with that being said, there's a couple other observations that you have to pay attention to. When you see reports or you hear reports, Sasquatch ran across Highway 85 or Sasquatch ran across the eye, and it was 10 feet, and it was big, it moved fast. Well, most likely, I bet you that was a male, a sole male, going off by himself, a traveler. Very, very, very rarely, very seldom, do you see reports of a female Sasquatch trailing two or three juveniles with her going across the road, running across a farmer's field. You don't hear those reports. What you hear are large males doing that. So are they traveling, looking for a mate? Don't know. I think it's too early to make a supposition about that. However, it's the fact that we don't observe females traveling. We don't observe females with babies traveling from area to area. That's kind of reminiscent of what you see with gorillas and baboons, orangutans, chimpanzees. Females don't travel all that far from where they were born. The males do, but not the females. So is there a relationship there? Maybe. Maybe where we see a female squatch or juveniles, that could represent a residential population that exists in that general area. And those general areas line up with karst topography, volcanic geology, and other areas where there are cavernous depositional geology. I take this serious, and I don't want to put anything out there that I can't substantiate. You know, like right. I said with orbs, I can't explain them. Are orbs maybe... Those could be microparticles of dark matter intersecting with some level of plasma, maybe? Or is it plasma that's been released and is following the magnetic contours of the planet? I don't know. Gosh, if we could reproduce that effect in a laboratory, it'd be a lot better way to figuring that out. But I wouldn't even begin to estimate how to do that. At least not right now.
So I know that if we had time that we would touch on a little bit of the paranormal side. What is your experience with that?
Well, start at the beginning. I have to date myself here. Back in 1972, I was 12 years old, and we were living at the time on the eastern shores of Oneida Lake in upstate New York, right by where the Erie Canal goes into Oneida Lake. The area now is called Verona Beach and Sylvan Beach. My parents owned a bar restaurant there called the Harbor Bar and Inn. And on that property, across on the other side of the parking lot, was an old 1950s bait shop. It was two stories. One and a half stories, but it was all padlocked up, and my parents used the garage portion of it to store lumber and paneling and stuff for the restaurant. Well, being the energetic kids my brother and I were, we couldn't get in the door. I mean, there wasn't like a living room kitchen thing. When you look in the window, there's a huge bait tank that would have water and bait fish, you know, in it, minnows and whatnot, and there looked to be an office in the back, but we just had to get in there, but it was all padlocked. But we were able to pry the garage door open enough to where we could just go right up underneath it and get into the garage. And so we did. We climbed this mountain of old lumber and 2x4s and plywood, etc., to where we could get to the rafters in the garage. And so I got up there first. My brother was coming up behind me. I get up on the rafters. I look across the building, the bait tank below me, and I look in the opposite corner. And there I see what looks like something that's about 5.5, 6 feet tall, very bony. It looked like a grown-up wearing a full-length skeleton costume with big, dark, black eyes. It slowly turned around and saw me. I just, out of here. I jumped down out of those rafters. I grabbed my brother, pushed him back underneath the garage door. I did the same. I kicked the stick out we used to pry it open, and we just took off back into the restaurant. I later described that to a couple people that are now friends of mine that are Oneida / Onondaga Indian from the area. And they told me what I observed was a rake. And I didn't know what quite to make about that, since I saw it before all the big reports became popular. But what had occurred after that, my parents had their falling out, and they separated for a period of time, and we moved about 40 miles away from there, a town called Westmoreland, New York, and we were living in a single-wide 60-foot trailer, 10-foot wide, and it was a brand-new trailer park. I mean, there was no grass. It was just dirt and rocks and trailers set up on cinder blocks, and my mom was still go back to the restaurant, and one night, my brother and I, home alone, we watched TV, and we went to bed. He had his room, I had mine, and we heard the front door just crash open, and something started walking through the living room, and we could hear my mom's bottle collection jingling, because, you know, it's a trailer. I mean, the floor's not all that stable, but bottles are clinking against one another as the footsteps get closer. I'm laying in my bed and I can see the shadow up on the wall getting closer. And all of a sudden, white static snow buzzing in my ears. The first time I ever disassociated. The next thing I know, it's 4 a.m. My mom is there. New York State Patrol is there. My brother's sitting in a chair in the living room. And my mom and the State Patrol are waking me up. I urinated on myself. And they're saying, what happened? The door's been ripped off the hinges, broken open, and everything else. And I didn't know what had occurred. I think maybe it was that rake looking for me. Not sure. So my mom and dad, they get back together again. My mom and my stepdad, they get back together again after that, a few months later. And we go back to that same house we were living at when we lived close to the restaurant. And I was back in my same old room again, and the headboard for my bed was up against the window. Now, this is the house next to a lake, and so my windowsill is about 6 feet taller than the ground is because of flooding, etc. issues. And so at night, I could lay in my bed, and I would see the light come through my window and project on the wall in front of me. So if you were to walk by, I would see your shadow. That's how prominent it was. And so here I am one night, and I wake up for some reason. I thought I heard something whispering, and I look up, and I can see the outline of a person, their shadow cast in the wall in front of me. Huge, huge. I didn't know what to do. I just froze, and all of a sudden, it dashed away. I heard the back door to our back mudroom, open and closed. And that's the last thing I remember. I just laid there in total fear. And my mom comes home. It's 2:33 o'clock, her and my stepdad. And they want to know what happened because someone broke into the back mudroom where they had two huge chest freezers. It looks like someone stole food out of those freezers. I don't know to cast that shadow, you had to have been 10 feet or more in height, or you had to have been hovering over the ground by the window. So things still didn't work out for Mom and Dad. And so Mom, my brother, and I, we left. We go to Florida. We're living in the north side of Ocala, and I get enrolled in Fessenden Middle School, North Marion County. Everything seemed to be fine. Every time I would go out in the woods, I would have this need to go out in the woods and climb a tree and sit by myself. Or just in today's world, explaining this to a psychologist, I was still suffering from the trauma of what I experienced in New York, but not knowing that at the time. And every time I'd go in the forest or go walk around in the woods, even though my friends would be playing tree fork or doing whatever, I just always had this feeling that something was following me or watching me. And so, anyhow, I would go back home all the time, and I sort of would isolate myself from people. And one thing led to another. My mom ultimately divorced my stepdad, and everything was fine. And she met another guy and went to Philadelphia, and I stayed there with my grandmother. And I ended up going to North Marion High School for half a year. So everything was fine. I go about life, and everything seems to be fine. About 2010, I start making the decision, making some life-changing decisions or life-affirming decisions, and about my transgenderism. And I confide in those two same friends that were in New York, and I confide in another friend in New Mexico, both Native Americans, on one side of Oneida Onagan Indian and the other Navajo. And each of them, unknowing of the other, each told me the same exact thing, that I represent a twin spirit. And that's why I attract these things to me. And that's why they perfectly understood the situation and decisions I was making, is because I'm twin spirited, supposedly. I'm polite. I've known these people for decades, and I'm not going to argue with them, and I'm just polite and whatnot. Remember that asterisk in that story I told you about? Let's go back to that, okay? Now, what each of them told me was coyotes or pranksters. They're known to be thieves and pranksters and jesters. But in rare cases, coyotes are protectors. They're protectors of spirits and twin spirits. So that sort of brings the story around, full circle.
When you saw it up there, it was likely protecting you from the Squatch, yeah, or Squatches.
Or whatever it was protecting me. And so where I live now in Columbia, South Carolina, I'm a beautiful home, very fortunate to have this. And I have problems with dark figures in my home. I've had two groups come out of Charleston to investigate. Each has told me the same thing independently. There's a 6-foot dark figure with no hands and no feet that sometimes materializes in my hallway and the entrance to my home and just stands there and stares at me. And there's another dark entity that is about 4.5 foot tall, that looks around the corner. I've caught it on video. We suspect she's a 12-year-old little girl, and she will open and close cupboards. On two occasions, I lay in bed and I look at my bedroom door, which I have locked and closed, and I leave the hallway light on, and I can see a shadow pass back and forth underneath the door. And I jump up, I grab a firearm, I'm yelling and screaming, get out of here, I'll shoot you, etc. The shadow goes away, and I look, open the door, and there's a stack of 12 pennies on the floor. That's where we come up with a 12-year-old. And because it's like a prank or something, we suspect this little girl. At the same time, I put security cams in every room of the house except the bathrooms with motion detectors. And when I first did that, the alarm went off for downstairs in the living room. And I'm in my bed. I grab my phone. And because I can look at every camera on my smartphone, I look at that camera that's activated, and you can see the top of someone's head look halfway around the corner and then scoot back. And they move their head out twice. And so I call the police. I call my HOA security company, and they send people out. I go downstairs, let them in. They search the whole house. They find nothing here. I show them the video. I go, look. And they go, yes, ma'am, we can see there's someone looking around the corner at you. However, they're not in your house now. So the best we could do with these two investigatory groups is, one, because I deal in antiques on the side, I'm to remove all the antiques from the house. And I have done so. And I've put crucifixes, crosses up in every room. The situation tends to subside. But when I come home from an expedition, and if there's been heavy interaction with Squash, those dark figures tend to come visit me. I can sit in my living room and see out of the corner of my eye. There'll be something standing there. I've been told not to react to it. Don't get excited. Don't give it the time of day. Don't empower it. And eventually go away. But it seems to go away between expeditions. But when I come back from an expedition, the first two or three nights is when I get those visitations.
Did you have any visitations after the most recent expedition we had in
Florida?
Yeah,
when I came home, I'm laying in bed. And I wake up, use the restroom. It's about 2:30 in the morning. And I'm just sitting on the side of my bed. And it feels like someone walked up and put their hand on my thigh and took it off. I can smell cigarette smoke. I don't smoke. I'm highly allergic to cigarette smoke. It agitates the hell out of me. I can smell cigarette smoke in my bedroom. And it felt like someone felt my thigh, put their hand on my thigh. I jump up, yelling and screaming, get out of here. This is nonsense. This is my house. It subsides. It goes away. Or I'm laying in bed, and it feels like someone has laid down with me. You can feel the bed move. It sort of sinks on that side. It's only a brief moment or two, and then it's gone. But it's there. I don't think these problems are worthwhile. But, during the summer, when it's off-season for squatching, things sort of subside and they go away and everything's fine. However, when I come back from multiple, I do between 10 and 12 expeditions a year, it tends to come back again. In Tennessee, I encountered the first time ever of experiencing mind speak. Prior to that occasion, I would have told you, I need to see the evidence. But I experienced it for myself. And I'm telling you, it's real. I'm sitting with a group of five people, and all night we've been talking on the radio, and the only nouns we used on the radio was Team 1, Team 2, Team 3, and Marcia. Okay? And all of a sudden, like someone was standing a foot behind me, my left ear, I hear someone cleanly and plainly say to me, Marcia, just like that. I jump up, and I'm looking around like, you guys had to have heard that. No, we didn't hear a thing. My first experience with mind speak, or have something in the forest call out you by name. I was like, maybe I got to pay attention to that.
Have you had any other instances of mind speak?
Now, when I sit and think about it, I may have, but I didn't know what it was, or I didn't make a connection. I suspect that I have had it. But I know when I was touched through the canvas of the side of my tent in Ohio, I woke up and I could hear breathing in a low growl about a foot from my face on the other side of the canvas. And I heard this white noise that went with it. Was that mind speak? I don't know. Maybe my tuner wasn't set to the right frequency. Don't know. But I know there was something knelt down on the ground on the other side of the wall of my tent, about a foot away, and I could hear it breathing, and I could hear it growl, I could hear it exhale as it got up and ran across the center of the camp, stole some food off the table, and came back. I could hear all that, and it was right there by my face. So now I'm more aware that it can happen. So right. I try to pay attention if it does.
Well, and I'll just say that I recall when we went out, I was really just blown away and really impressed. I really enjoyed how thorough and meticulous that you were. And even when we had gone out, we had a little bit of an activity that night. Yeah. I know we did the same kind of situation, like you were saying, yes, where the two groups split. And
Go ahead. You explain what your experience, and then I'll give you the direction as to why we did it.
Yeah, well, from my point of view, and I think it was, like you said, like around five people total, we had two groups split up. And I know Lori yep. was in one of them, and yeah. her and another gentleman had gone to the left, and we had mm-hmm. gone to the right. And exactly. we were walking and seeing if, you know, anything started up. We had checked in with you on the radio, and you were like, mm-hmm. I've got movement over here. It's something, we've got movement. And even
do you understand why we did that?
Was to agitate the environment.
Yeah, agitate the environment, but to do it in a safe manner. Okay. When you and your partner went out to the north, went to the right, okay, you didn't go alone, first off.
Okay? Right.
And second, you were intended to talk and make noise, etc. And when you did, if you recall, you had a tree knock super close to you. Super close.
Oh, yeah.
And now, keep in mind, tree knocks are not for our benefit. Tree knocks indicate that there's two or more Squatches because they're communicating between themselves. Right? Otherwise, mm-hmm. why are they doing it? So
right.
when you guys heard that tree knock like 10, 15 feet off the trail, and you heard it leaving and coming back. So that Squatch was communicating with another one, which we suspect was what? Part of the movement I was spotting in front of me with the FLIR.
Mm-hmm.
And Lori mm-hmm. and Jeff, who went the other way down the trail, they would hear, remember they heard a howl or they heard, et cetera. They heard what they thought was movement and they were trying to identify was it another group that was doing it or not, but they were too far away. And it sort of coalesced with the movement I was seeing with my FLIR. And so then all of a sudden they hear a tree knock. Mm-hmm. So here we have two Squatches probably hunkered down on that trail that are watching us, right? And they're telling each other that there's movement and what's going on is what they're doing. Now, on my equipment, I had infrasound at 9.8 hertz on several occasions. I had electromagnetic field of approximately 60 microtesla sporadically throughout that entire encounter. So there was a method to my madness for doing that the way I did it. I wanted to make sure everyone's safe. The utmost above everything is safety. If there was any chance of a coyote, a wolf, a feral dog, a hog, a moose, you name it, I want to make sure you're not going to be encountering that, okay? I don't want anyone hurt. So that's the first thing. If you notice, when we go out, I lead. I'm the first one out there. And if something's going to jump out of the forest and get on us, it's going to get to me first. So I'm not going to say, okay, everyone, get out of the cars and let me know if it's safe. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be the first one out there. And you notice, I walk over, I pick a spot, I check everything out first to make sure it's safe. And I carry all the first aid kits, the extra water, everything. That's why everyone gets out carrying the chair, but I'm carrying three backpacks. Electronic equipment, water, first aid kit, aren't I? You can tell the audience, you know. I carry all that safety equipment because it's my concern that everyone be safe first. Because we can come back later. We can do this once a week for the rest of our lives, but if someone gets hurt, they can't. So I don't want that to occur. And then on the other side of that coin, because of what I've been told by people whom I respect, that I seem to attract this because supposedly I'm twin-spirited, I tend to attract this. And I know in Ohio, I know we have interaction with squatches there on a quite regular basis. If you had a chance to come up there, let me know. Let me know. I think you'll be blown away. But then again, I feel that they see and they recognize certain people, and I'm one of them. So for good, bad, or indifferent, I've had orbs reported by others circling, hovering over my tent at night. I've had all my radios, my cell phone, everything go dead. And I'm trying to reach out and contact others saying, hey, what's going on? And I'm hearing, Marcia, stay in your tent. There's orbs around you. That kind of thing. I look out the window of my tent and I look down slope about 30 yards away. And there's a young adult squatch standing by the corner of the tent of one of our other attendees. And he's shaking the corner of their tent. Like, whoa, you know, whoa. I should put this out there. The BFRO is a field research organization. They are not critter ritter. If you have a problem with a squatch, it's not like calling Ghostbusters. Okay? We're not going to come out there with unregistered nuclear power packs and zap a squatch and make it leave your property. We're there to a dual mission. One is community relations and education, and the other is research, collecting data. And we want to do that with a certain level of integrity. And a lot of people don't like that, and I can't help them for that. But I know from those whom I meet and know, they'd rather walk away from anything that's 99% and only stay with what they physically see record at 100%. So, reach out, you know, a few months from now or a couple times a year. I'd be more than happy to share what we're seeing out in the field.
Marcia, thank you so much for joining me and sharing your incredible experiences and insight. Your decades of dedication to this field research and your scientific approach and just your openness to the unknown is truly inspiring.
Well, thank you.
It's been an honor to have you on Dark Florida.
I'll tell you right now, I graduated Interlochen High School, okay? That's in Putnam County, between St. Augustine and Gainesville. That's where I graduated high school. I can tell you right now, there's been Class A sightings right there in Putnam County. Outside, right between Floral Home and Interlochen, there was a couple squatches out there agitating some people because they had fruit trees on their property. Those reports are quite clear. I'm not going to try to convince anyone that squatches exist. I've seen them myself 3 times with my own naked eye. So I don't try to convince people. I try to share with them the experiences I have and share this enjoyment and love I have for being out in the field. I've been in the field as a Marine, as a geologist, and now this for, gosh, over 45 years of my life. This is what I do. And so, anyhow, it was good talking to you, Brick.
Yes, likewise. I hope we can have you back in the future. And there's just so much to explore. So thank you again for coming on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Contact me in a few months. I'll give you an update on what we're seeing in the field.
All right. That sounds good. A huge thank you to Marcia Clark for sharing her incredible journey and expertise with us tonight. From the scientific to the unexplained, her dedication to uncovering the truth and her willingness to guide others along the way is truly inspiring. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe to Dark Florida wherever you listen to podcasts, and don't forget to leave a 5-star review. It really helps the channel. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. If you have a story of your own or would like to be a guest on the show, reach out to me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for exploring the unknown with me. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.